Where Britain goes, we go. Michael Joseph Savage from the old days. There were still people who were alive when he said that at the outbreak of World War II. A lot has happened in a lifetime. And we know that a week is a long time in politics, but it would take a miracle of some sort, you'd think, to stop Sir Keir Starmer becoming Britain's next Prime Minister. At the moment, he's the proverbial shoo-in anyway. Labour's 20 points ahead in the polls. The Reform Party is creeping up behind the Tories. It doesn't matter to us as much as it once did what happens in British politics. The UK now is only New Zealand's seventh largest trading partner. Two-way trade is worth about $5 billion. We sell wine, meat, fruit, eggs, honey and wool, comprising about $1.5 billion worth of that $5 billion. But a quarter of a million New Zealanders were born in the UK, and many, many more, of course, have parents or grandparents who were. Most Pākehā, many Māori have British ancestry, and we're still sort of ruled by the king. We know quite a lot about him, not so much about Sir Keir. And as an orator, he's not exactly in the big league, even if his heart seems to be in the right place.
Imagine if a whole country said, "We back your potential." Imagine if a whole country commits properly to unlocking the pride you have for your community. Then look what we could build. A Britain where every contribution is equally respected. Where you don't have to change who you are just to get on. Where whatever your background, you can feel certain that your effort will be rewarded. The future will be better for your children.
Keir Starmer, the biography, has been written by Tom Baldwin. Tom's a British journalist, author and former Labour Party senior advisor. On the other hand, he's written for the Conservative, with a small c, papers, The Times and The Telegraph. And as well, there's been the book Control-Alt-Delete, about technology's abusive relationship with truth in media and politics. He was communications director at the People's Vote campaign, which unsuccessfully tried to have a second referendum over the UK leaving Europe. Tom Baldwin, hello. Very good to talk with you about Keir Starmer.
Oh, hello.
Hello. It's not an authorised biography, is it? But you seem to have had huge access, Tom, yeah?
Yeah, I've used the phrase authoritative rather than authorised. I've spoken to, done interviews with Keir Starmer maybe 24 times. I've spoken to his family, his friends, his shadow cabinet colleagues, his closest advisors. And, it's unusual to get that degree of access for a British political leader at this stage in the cycle, particularly one like him who's sort of seen as pretty cautious usually. I think the reason why he cooperated to the extent that he did is because he knows quite a lot of people, even though it looks like they're going to vote Labour, are still asking a lot of questions about who he is, where he's from, and what he wants to do.
Yeah, exactly. Still interesting, though, because it's taking a risk on his part as well. So that's interesting in itself. An ordinary-looking man in a hurry to get somewhere. That's the first line of your book, and it's repeated as the last line of your book. And in between...
Well spotted.
And in between is a picture of a man we can't entirely get to know, yes?
No, in a way he doesn't really want everybody to know everything about him, in a way that most people don't. And I'm trying to sort of, at one point I was going to call the book The Unpolitician, because he's someone who didn't become a politician until he was 52. And he doesn't really like politics. He doesn't like having to do the things that politicians do, like have this backstory and vision. It's like, it's not normal. If someone came up to you in the street and said, "I've just had a vision," you'd more likely direct them to hospital than to Downing Street.
And he's getting better as a politician. But you're right, he's still a sort of unpolitician. There's a quote in your book from a writer, I forget, in The Spectator, after one of his speeches. "Words plopped from Sir Keir Starmer's lips like dumpling dough off a wooden spoon." And that is not the kind of, that is not the kind of man you associate with the highest office in the land. And that's part of his problem, isn't it? I mean, Rishi Sunak's got his own baggage, but that's part of Sir Keir's problem.
Well, it's a paradox in it, isn't it? Because everybody keeps telling opinion polls in this country that they hate politicians. And yet everyone I know in politics keeps saying, "Well, I wish Keir Starmer was more like a politician, did things that politicians do." And he's doing something right. You know, he's 20 points clear in the opinion polls, having been 20 points behind when he took over. But he's doing it in a sort of slightly ugly, inelegant, unconventional way, which is exasperating journalists. It's exasperating some of his own colleagues because they don't quite understand him, and he doesn't really want them to understand him.
And we've had leaders here of that ilk, and they go on to be successful leaders. But 52% of voters think he's doing badly in a recent YouGov poll I saw. You're in the same curious situation in the UK, aren't you, as US voters are, a choice between two leaders that at this stage they don't really want?
Keir Starmer is certainly less popular than the Labour Party as a whole. He's, you know, he's the least unpopular leader in Britain at the moment.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I think there's a sort of, we maybe have to sort of change the way we think about politics, because we've been used to these very charismatic, rather powerful leaders, you know, whether it's Thatcher or Blair or Johnson. And I say at some point in the book that, you know, so much of politics has become sort of spectacle. You know, Blair would conjure up these castles in the sky, which didn't always get beyond the artistic impression. And Boris Johnson would gather this huge crowd around him as he set fire to lots of the things we valued most. And Starmer is quite boring to watch. You know, he talks about building blocks, and no one watches people moving building blocks around for very long. But in the end, someone moving building blocks around has built a house, and the others have just made speeches. And his leadership does seem to be getting results. He has changed the Labour Party at a great speed in a way that no one really thought was possible.
And yes, and I'm maybe electorates are moving towards appreciating the need for building blocks rather than castles in the sky. But it's interesting you mention that, because we all talk about these situations without really analysing them in everyday conversations, but it probably says an awful lot about the zeitgeist and the pressure being brought to bear on politics, and perhaps about the impossibility of satisfying the disparate elements in societies like ours now, that we have leaders that we don't want, who then, in the case of the Tories anyway, fail one after the other. You know, it doesn't bode well, perhaps, until there's a change of approach by people.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a sort of battle of wills between the media and the rest of politics on the one hand, and Keir Starmer on the other, if you like. You know, can we have a different kind of politics which doesn't pretend it can solve everything, but tries to fix some things? Does it? Can we have a politics which says there isn't a simple, big, rhetorical answer, a big radical vision? Things are complicated. The problems are complicated. The solutions are complicated. And actually, he's quite complicated. He's flawed as a politician. He may not be able to overcome the challenges because of it. But I do think it's quite interesting that the media just refuses to sort of take seriously someone who doesn't jump through their hoops, as, you know, Boris Johnson has been a sort of great entertainer and everyone loved him until he really screwed up.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's a kind of case for different kind of politics. I don't know whether he'll prevail.
This guarded man, speaking of what you've just said, this guarded man I saw him described as in The Independent. Mm. In terms of his vision, I know, okay, so he's a solid building block politician. Is he like Biden, you know, who the accusation against Biden is that his opinions are seemingly blown on the wind of advice from those close to him? Or is he more his own man than that? Because he's taken steps and then stepped backwards on a number of issues, as politicians do, actually. So what's your impression of, you know, how ideological he is?
I don't think he's very ideological at all. And sometimes when I say that, people think I mean that he's technocratic. I don't think that's the case either. I think he's got values in a way that most ordinary people do have values. But if you ask them to codify them, they would struggle. Or ask them to place those values on some ideological spectrum, they'd struggle. I think his values are quite reassuringly British in a way, about decency and fair play and justice and that and such like. And in terms of how he expresses those values, again, it looks curious. I mean, I sometimes use this metaphor of watching a man standing still in a field. He takes one step forward and two steps sideways and one step back and one step to the right and then two steps forward. People think, what the hell's he doing? And the answer is he's crossing a minefield. And we so often want our politicians to charge forward on a horse, into the valley of death they rode. There's not to reason why, there's but to do or die. And they do die.
Yeah.
And I think Starmer's approach may be the best way of getting to the other side.
Keir Starmer, the biography, Tom Baldwin is talking to us. He actually has a more working class background than any Labour leader for several decades now, doesn't he? We think of him as a nice middle class man, but he did it tough.
Yeah, and that's the other paradox. I mean, he's the first Labour leader to become Labour leader with a Sir attached to his name. And he's probably also the most working class one for a while. He does talk about class, and that's a lot about his dad, who is this rather sort of overbearing, scary figure, and his big sort of Amish-style beard, always wore shorts and sandals, and he was a toolmaker in this very middle-class, rural area of England, Surrey, where no one really understands what a toolmaker is. I mean, if you're a toolmaker in Burnley or Blackburn, they know that a toolmaker is someone who studied for 8 years. But Starmer's dad, was just someone who worked in a factory, and people looked down on him. And something that burns quite hard in Starmer, this sense that people aren't respected for what they do. People, he talks about snobbery in class in a way that no Labour leader has for quite a long time.
His dad, Rod, looked, quote, like a cross between a Victorian patriarch and an American frontiersman emerging from a few years of living alone in the woods. And the telephone got cut off and the bills weren't always paid. But much of the air of Starmer Reserve comes from his actually quite tragic family circumstances beyond what we've talked about.
Yeah, and his mother was very ill. She had this disease called Still's disease, which your immune system attacks itself, and she had chronic arthritis from a very early age and was told she'd never have children. And Starmer talks a lot about her in my book. He talks about how just getting out of bed and walking downstairs was painful to her, but she did it. And he applies that to himself in terms of how he regards politics. Every step forward is painful. He doesn't want to do it, but he does it. I think it also explains why he's quite buttoned up and tightly bound, because in that family, there wasn't room for someone else to have problems. It was all about keeping his mum alive. He had also had a brother with quite severe learning difficulties. And so there wasn't room to learn to emote. You kept yourself to yourself. And again, that's not what we're used to in politicians. Most politicians like nothing more than talking about themselves at great length. Starmer really doesn't like doing it.
And at school, he played football at lunchtime and during the breaks from class. So he wouldn't have to admit what to his classmates.
His dad, who really was quite terrifying sometimes, wouldn't allow him to have a TV for most of his childhood, and so everyone would be getting together to talk about what they'd seen on TV last night, Starsky and Hutch or whatever was on in the 70s, and he wouldn't be able to join in the conversation, so he'd say, let's play football. And so he's always used football to normalize himself, and I think he still does.
Yeah, he's a big football fan. Tell us a bit more, please, about how this might propel someone towards leadership, the so-called phaeton complex, exhibited actually by many British prime ministers.
Yeah, I mean, there is this theory that people who've had trauma in their childhood are more driven to succeed. I think, sometimes you have to be a bit careful. Like, I want my son to get on. I better make sure he has some trauma. You don't do that. But he does seem to have that in common. He doesn't pretend that his difficulties in his childhood are unique. I mean, everyone's got their problems. I think what's interesting about him is how that suffering and emotional buttoned upness has created a politician who I think kind of looks and feels a bit more like the country than most of our politicians usually do. Mm. Most people don't go around talking about their backstories and, what their childhoods or their visions. It's, politicians' behaviour is quite abnormal when we think about it. And if you want someone ordinary, it's actually someone who doesn't want to talk about everything, expose every part of his private life to public scrutiny. And so I've had to sort of chisel quite a lot of this out of him. That's why it took 24 interviews.
Yeah, you have chiselled a lot out, because politicians only tell us the backstories they think suit them well. But it's interesting, I dug a bit into the Phaeton complex, and of the 24 British prime ministers who held office over a period of more than a century, actually, 62% of these men had lost one or both parents by age 15, which was a huge percentage compared to the normal population. So that kind of makes... We instinctively understand that this might instill that kind of grit that would propel you through all sorts of vicissitudes, yeah?
Yeah, and, he doesn't sort of... There's not a lot of joy in how he proceeds. It's all about duty. I've got to get through this. I sometimes think, he regards everything that is a bit unsavoury about politics and puts it in the same bucket of things I don't really want to do. So breaking a promise... he puts in the same category as having to talk more about his mother, because I think other politicians would regard it differently. It's just like one of those bad things I have to do. I'm going to get on with it. It's tough, but it's what I've got to do to win. And so he does do all this stuff. I mean, the reason why I've been able to write a book about him, 360 odd pages, is because he will talk about it when pushed, but he is very, very reluctant, and you're dragging it out of him. And I think that's sort of, in a strange way, if someone's not sort of emoting and spilling it all out immediately, it actually makes them more interesting. You're having to pull it out of them, maybe because it was an effort, but also because it's not sort of all ready-made as a brand and, focus grouped. It's quite raw, some of this stuff.
Yeah, you have pulled a lot out. Keir Starmer, the biography, Tom Baldwin, is talking to us. Well, the UK obviously badly needs someone from one side of the political spectrum or the other who can solve problems rather than talk about them. And interestingly, although Liberal politicians are often sneered at as not having worked in proper jobs, he, in his former role as Director of Public Prosecutions, developed a healthy, I'm paraphrasing you really, a healthy respect for the guardians of society. I mean, he won't be defunding the police anytime soon.
No, well, it's interesting because he's on a journey throughout his legal career. He starts as this very radical human rights lawyer, railing against these excesses of the state in the miners' strike and the Wapping dispute and the way they arrest people in the streets. And slowly he applies human rights law more to what's happening to victims of crime as much as alleged perpetrators of crime. And then he becomes the chief prosecutor in England and Wales. A lot of his old lefty mates were up in arms about this. They thought he was one of them. And he said, human rights applies to a young woman who has been sexually abused and can't get justice just as much as it applies to an asylum seeker who can't get citizenship in this country. You've got to, human rights can't just work on one side if they're going to be accepted. That's his argument.
Yeah. This is the large question. Britain, if all you read were its tabloids, is an ungovernable mess. Even though that's hyperbole, we can still see the disillusion and the distress and the knife crime, state of the NHS, sagging exports, cost of living, everything really. Borrowing costs on your national debt increasing year after year, and we can see ourselves in that mirror actually to a less extreme extent, which is why your politics interest us. Is he the man that can somehow change all that though? Because this is what voters, I know that sounds like a naive sort of question, but this is the sort of question voters have in their minds.
I think that's a really interesting question, because I mean, I used to be a journalist for a long time, and I know how we're always looking to dramatise every crisis, turn every problem into a crisis, because it makes for better headlines and a more ferocious debate and better viewing figures and whatever. And we kind of got addicted to these polarised, divisive debates where everyone's screaming at each other and no one can hear what anyone else is saying. And I'm not sure that's where most people really are or what they really want. I mean, we've had Brexit and we've had austerity and we've had Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, and we've had sort of deep, deep polarizing divisions in this country. I think what's interesting is whether we can have politics which doesn't always run in straight lines. They're the enemy. These are our friends. These are our big solutions. It's about whether you can bend into the folds of national life a bit more. You know, like our road system goes round hills and it gets there in the end. And I don't want to sound too folksy and too optimistic about it, but I do think there's probably more appetite for a calmer, more grown-up, more unifying politics in this country than you would guess reading our tabloid newspapers or watching some of our TV stations at the moment.
It's funny, you know, without a vision, the people perish, is the old saying. And, of course, with vision, the people perish. You've seen that recently with Liz Truss and Boris Johnson and so on. All right, so... But at the same time, Rishi Sunak, when he came to power, seemed to be the steady hand on the tiller, and that hasn't worked for him. But then his party's riven, isn't it, in a way that Labour's not riven anymore?
Well, that, I think, is why, you know, some people say Starmer is just sort of lucky general. He's been blessed by his opponents. He hasn't really done much to get the position he's in. But I think what he did do is he changed his party. He talks about turning his party inside out. For a long time, Labour looked inwards. All that mattered was the activists and the members and what they thought. And, yeah, if you want to be a cabinet minister or frontbencher or even get selected MP, all you care about then is the activists. And so you've got a kind of a party that's talking to itself rather than to the country. He's changed the party, he's changed the rules so that people are now, you know, political candidates for the Labour Party are now forced to look outwards to the electorate, to address the electorate rather than the membership. At the same time, the Conservative Party, which was always the party, natural party of government, a sensible party which did sensible things, seems to have gone off into the sort of, you know, marshy badlands, the fringes of politics. And so, I mean, no one really thought Liz Truss was going to actually do the things she was telling Tory party members in the summer of 2023. But, you know, no one thought that she'd actually sort of tried to actually do any of this stuff. And she, then she got to 2022, and then she got elected, and she did it. And the markets reacted in horror, and the public reacted in horror. But she'd been telling this, she'd been just talking to the Conservative Party all summer. And it's this very strange phenomenon now where a very small group of people, 70, 80,000 people, who are not really represented in the country, are electing successive prime ministers without general election. And they're getting odder and odder. So Sunak comes in to replace Liz Truss without having to go to the membership, who's just appointed by the MPs. And he starts off quite conventional, you know, trying to contest that ground of competence and integrity with Starmer. But slowly he's pulled off into these marshlands himself because he's not in control of his party. And his party likes the marshlands at the moment.
The party that likes the marshlands. I like
you. They're almost painting themselves with woad, you know.
Okay, so he wants to get things done. He's got his five missions, but they're broad ones, as you concede. I saw an essay, this is quoted in the book, an essay on his vision, described as written with cliches, a groaning tumbrel of dead metaphors trundling along the slow road to nowhere. He is deeply impelled, you say, by a passion for human rights and the dignity of man, Tom. The dignity of man being the old phrase, you know. Isn't this the wrong age for that? Because this may, again, this is just speculation, this may turn out to be the age the pendulum swung back towards populism and impatience with human rights and sending refugees to Rwanda. I mean, we may have reached the current peak of liberalism. If so, he would be a man out of time. But you suspect he's not a man out of time. He's a man whose time... seemingly has well and truly come.
Look, maybe the proof will be in the pudding. You know, he would himself say he's done nothing yet. He hasn't been elected, prime minister. It wasn't that Mario Cuomo, the New York American Democrat, once said, you know, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Starmer will campaign in prose and govern in bullet points.
As you say, it's not a done deal. I know it seems like one with a 20% difference in the polls, but a week is a long time in politics, etc. So you think people will come actually to value him? That'll happen.
I suspect he will become prime minister. I mean, lots can change. The politics in Britain is very volatile still. And so, his poll lead could yet evaporate. I doubt it, because I don't think the Tories are showing much sign of wanting to survive. But I don't want to sound like I'm sort of making Starmer out to be some sort of panacea or he's perfect. He's not.
Yeah.
He's got many flaws as a politician. He doesn't have the performative skills I think perhaps are needed to hold the country together through quite challenging times. He hasn't been good at making alliances within the party, and I think he'll need some of those when times are tough. So it may be that he's overwhelmed by the challenges or limited by his own political shortcomings.
Thank you for the book. Two big and unfair questions to end with. How long before Britain rejoins the EU, do you think?
Well, this is one of the areas I disagree with Keir Starmer, because I campaigned for a second referendum before we finally left
the
European Union in 2020. And I'd like to see him be a bit bolder on this. Probably not talk about rejoin, but I think that he could go further and talk about rejoining a customs union or the single market at the moment. He's very incremental, and there is low-hanging fruit, and he'll go step by step towards closer alignment, I think, with the European Union. And all incrementalism eventually ends up in a big choice. I don't know when that will be, but he'd prefer it not to be in the lifetime of the next parliament. So I don't think he wants to make a big decision about Europe anytime soon. But there is a lot of economic logic which suggests that we're not going to be able to grow our economy or matter on the big debates and some of the challenges facing our continent unless we are much, much more involved in Europe than we are.
That's not how Boris described it, Tom. Can Great Britain...
Where is he now?
Can Great Britain be great again economically? And I've still got all that stature in the world, I know. But, to borrow a Trump playbook phrase, can Great Britain be great again, do you think? Is there a rosy future for the country in the next little while rather than someday in the future again?
I think this phrase greatness is part of the problem. Can we make things work better than they do? Can we get more opportunity for young people? Can we, try and fix some of the problems with the NHS? Can we try and harness new green technology to get a cleaner, cheaper energy in the future? Yeah, I think you can do some of that, but this constant sort of hang-up Britain's got about restoring our greatness. These are the sort of big, grandiose myths which get in the way of getting things done on the ground. I don't think we can fix everyone or restore national greatness. I mean, there was a particular peculiar set of circumstances in the 19th century which meant that Britain became a preeminent power, and they're not going to be repeated anytime soon. Thank God. Because they involved terrible exploitation of people and so on. But can we make things work better for the British people? Yes. Can we be a more responsible country on the world stage? Yes. Can we make some progress step by step across the minefield that all countries face? Yes, we can. And we shouldn't sort of give up because we're reaching so high to greatness to actually making things a bit better. That's what politics really is, the choice between a bit better and in this case, a lot worse.
Thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on the book, Tom.
I'm told Jacinda Ardern is reading the book as we speak.
There you go.
She was given a copy. She was given a copy when she was in London. She started reading it on the train.
Oh, that's a very good sign. Hey, lovely to talk. All the best with the book, and thanks for giving us your time.
Well, thank you very, very much. Really appreciate you having me.